let's see if we can reset the scene here so that we kind of get this flavor. And if you recall, we shared briefly last week in our abbreviated time together from chapter 8, where Israel is demanding and asking, we need to have a king like everybody else has a king. You go all the way around the dial of the nations around them, and they all had kings. Everyone has a king except us. And then you recall at the beginning of chapter 8, one of the reasons they don't want, that they'd say they want a king is because, Samuel, your sons are not following in the ways of God. Now, you've got to imagine what kind of a heartbreak this was to Samuel. And we talked a little bit. There was some differences between Samuel's sons and Eli's sons, but nonetheless, it was not a pretty picture. And it was not God's perfect will that Israel have a king. He wanted to directly rule them through his presence. And you remember, God says, I'm going to be right there in the midst of you. I'm going to dwell. My glory is going to dwell above the mercy seat in the Holy of Holies. I'm going to be here. I want to rule directly in what we used a theological term of a theocracy, where the direct rule of God. And they are rejecting that. And if you recall in chapter 8, and if you want to look at verse 7, you get just a flavor of this, 8:7. And the Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. So there's several levels of what is going on, likely in Samuel's life. One is God tells him, don't be rejected. So he's probably dealing with feeling somewhat rejected. After all, I have ruled in this particular fashion, in this scheme of things for all of these years. Now Israel's saying, don't want that anymore. Well, what a legacy I'm leaving. Also, there's the family connection that we already referenced in just a moment. And I think Samuel, in a deep level, when God says that they have rejected me, God says they've rejected me, that I should not rule over them, I think there was heartbreak there. Because he knew it was one further step of God's people turning in a way that God did not want them to go. So God gives Samuel the task in chapter 9 of, I don't want to say selecting, because God makes the selecting, but he's the one who points out, we'll say it that way, who the first king is going to be. It is Samuel's job to eventually, when we come to chapter 10, verse 1 and following, to anoint Saul as the first king of Israel. I just happen to believe that Saul's heart is not in it, both personally, professionally, and most of all, as far as his prophetic ministry before God, because this wasn't what God wanted, it wasn't what he wanted, it wasn't what touched his heart in a particular way. So there are those moments, and now you're going to have to help me here. You're going to have to help me make this translation into your life of what it is, some of the things that maybe you don't like to do, that you know is the right thing, that is just what God wants you to do. And here's where I want you to be. I want you to be at peace with that. And sometimes it's what God allows, that if I were ruling things, I wouldn't allow that. But we just have to be at peace and be comfortable with God's rule. Because God, as we looked at this morning in that powerful text from Isaiah 6, God is God. He is on the throne. He is high and lifted up. He is holy. His glory does fill all of the earth. He is the one who purges and purges sin and forgives iniquities. And he's the one that says, I've sent you forth. I'm going to send you forth with a message that's going to be very hard upon people when they hear it. But it's the message I want you to deliver. So let's jump into the text down chapter 1. It kind of sets the preface for who Saul is, even though at this point, Samuel has no idea who is going to be the king. Samuel has no idea how God is going to lead him to appoint the king. All he knows at this point is that God is going to use him in the prophetic office to do what he doesn't want to have happen anyway, but he's going to be used to call forth the first king of Israel. It says in verse 1, there was a man of Benjamin, so that was his tribal identity, whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechorath, the son of Ephiah, a Benjamite, a mighty man of power. So you have this man named Kish, you have his family history, you have his tribal identity. Verse 2, and he had a son. He had a son whose name was Saul. So there we're introduced to Saul. We'll read the description on in that verse in just a moment. I want to share five things with you to just help us to just, as it says, to be at peace with what God does, even when what that is not always what we choose. Number one, we need to accept what God allows. If God allows it, we need to accept it. In this case, God was allowing Israel to go down this path to have a king, and the first place he is named in all of Scripture is right here in 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 2, this man named Saul. God is allowing it because the people demanded it. Remember, God has already said, they've rejected me from ruling over it. Don't you feel down about it, Saul, Samuel, because they've rejected you. Feel like they've rejected you, they've rejected me. So God allows. Have you ever thought about this? I mean, it's a scary thought when you think about it. The enormous amount of freedom of choice that God somehow allows us. And there's this divine mystery that I am certainly not going to resolve for you. And I've come to this age, at the age of 55, to conclude that there is no one that's ever been on this earth can fully resolve this. It's how God is sovereignly in control of everything. And at the same time, he gives man the choice to fall into sin. Sin is not something God causes. God is not the author of sin. That's on us. How we can have this great moral freedom and God be totally in charge, it's all true. How it all fits together, that's where it gets difficult. But from our point of view, in the Garden of Eden, they had one rule to follow. Wouldn't that be simple? There are more than 600 commands in the Old Testament alone. But on that day, there was one rule, one tree, don't eat. I mean, you could put that in, you know, a very compact sentence. You could write that out on the back of a business card with a dull pencil and still have room left over. You know, one tree, don't eat. But he gave them the freedom, if they so choose. And they exercised that choice through the deception of Satan. Pull the fruit off, Eve, Adam, us, and you know the rest of the story. We've seen this in think of children, and think of young people, and think of maybe some of our family. You think of a father whose son is now turning 18. And now you have, at least legally, you have less leverage than you used to have. You hope your 18-year-olds don't figure this out. But legally, you have less leverage. And you think of a father. Now the son's starts down this path of hanging out in the bars and hanging out with the drinking crowd and the party crowd and the nightclub crowd, and where all of those kind of things are not particularly conducive for Christian edification. Should we say it that way? And you could hear the father, Heavenly Father, I pray, just stop my son from making that trip to that next watering hole and the next scene that's going to go on where he's heading on Friday night. Lord, I pray that you would stop him. But oftentimes, God allows man to make his choice and to face the consequences of their irresponsible behavior. Israel is about to encounter, from this point on in history, and he warns them, and that was part of the warning back there in chapter 8. In fact, in Deuteronomy, Moses had pre-warned the people what it would be like if you ever have a king. And now he says, they want to go down that path, I'm going to just say, go right ahead. And they're going to have to live with the consequences of it. You know, if we could set everything up, we'd just say, God, stop that. Prevent that. End that. Don't let that person make that choice. But you know what? We have to be at peace and just accept that God does allow people, for however it works and for whatever reasons, he allows people to the freedom to make choices. And we as a race of humanity have a very dismal record of our exercise of that freedom, do we not? And you don't have to look outside this room. I mean, we just look at ourselves. We have a pretty dismal record of how we have exercised in our lives and still struggle with that today. Sometimes we just think, you know, sometimes when there's a great disaster, you know, there's people starving in some country, or there's been some earthquake somewhere. Lord, why don't you do something? Why don't you intervene? Could God intervene and stop the earthquake and feed people? Absolutely. But sometimes God just allows this sin-cursed, sin-soaked, out-of-control world just to continue to feel the reverberation of sin entering into the domain of man that started in the Garden of Eden with one rule disobeyed by one man and one woman, and we face the consequences of it. You just have to be at peace and just have to accept that God allows things to happen. He doesn't stop everything. I could almost imagine Samuel saying, Lord, no, just change their minds, change their heart, stop this from happening. God says, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to allow it. That's not a particularly hopeful thing to our very rosy thinking about life. But God does allow things. Secondly, we need to accept this, and this is right here in verse 2. Accept that men, and I mean that by not men versus women, but men as in mankind, humans, accept that men are externally focused. Look what it says about Saul here. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a choice and handsome young man. There was not a more handsome person than he among the children of Israel. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. God uses a lot of print to talk about how good looking this guy is. Frankly, I don't think anybody should be that good looking, but what God allows, I need to accept. And he allowed this guy to be a really good-looking guy. He was tall. He stood out in a crowd. And he says he was just the most handsome, dashing, attractive man you could ever hope to see, in essence. Why does he put that in? How does that contribute to the text? How does that make him a godly man? How does that make him a proper king for Israel? How does that make him a man selected by God? It doesn't. Later when, and we'll see this in Samuel's life as well, when Saul is rejected from being king, and Samuel for the second time goes out to select a new king, whom we know as David, God has to whisper in his ear and says something similar to this. Man looks on the outside, I look on the heart. But mankind is all externally focused. We, if someone looks like they fit the part from central casting, we're gonna put them in the role. You want to know why Saul was king? Because he fit the part externally, and God was allowing them to have what they had, but also he was going to help them understand. You're going to live with the consequences of a man whose heart is not where it should be. Now, I don't want to say that Saul is all bad. He certainly was not all good. But I don't say he's all bad. But he was not of the character and the temperament as, say, David was to be the king over Israel. But people are externally focused. Now, we need to accept that. We need to accept. We don't like that. I mean, we would just like to think that people would think about the deeper things of life. Right, wrong, what is moral, what is best, what is spiritual, what is wholesome. We would love if everybody just were fastened on those deep and abiding truths. But you know what people are focused on? They're focused on the external. Both the external of what they see and the external of what they experience. Oh, I'm so excited about seeing this new thing, or having this new thing, or having this great experience. Don't be shocked, in other words, of how shallow the vast majority of human experience is. You think about what we value. If we could just value it economically in this country, okay? What we value economically. Who are the people that are making the most money for doing what is probably the least significant things? You want to pick on movie stars? They're an easy target. Okay, let's pick on them. Harrison Ford made it at least in excess, it's estimated, of $100 million, and who knows how high it went over that, for saying words that he didn't even write in front of a camera and looking good doing it for the Star Wars movie just came out. He made like 10 times more than the principal actors who no one ever heard of before they got put in the movie. Now, you know, people pay you, take the paycheck, I guess, but what about someone that's feeding the poor or helping people overcome cancer or trying to find a cure for some deadly disease or our missionaries that are preaching the gospel that touches someone's souls? We're externally focused. And before we cast too many stones out there, we can fall into this trap as well. Does this person fit the part? Does this thing look good? How does this make me feel? You just have to accept that. And yes, we fight against it. It doesn't mean that we cooperate with it, but maybe I should say it this way. Don't be shocked when you try to present the truth of you have a need for Christ in your life and people are focused on playing their video game. Or when you try to talk about the condemnation of sin, they're focused on the next little gadget or gizmo they want to buy. See, we struggle with this. And just don't be alarmed with it. Don't be shaken with it. But also understand this, that as God calls out for himself people after his name, he can rescue people from this externally based focus in life. And we of all people need to deal with the deeper things of life, of what God is pleased with, of how we can grow and serve him. Now, it gets into a very interesting story about lost donkeys starting from this point on. Verse 3. Now the donkeys of Kish, this is Saul's father, were lost. And Kish said to his son Saul, "Please take one of the servants with you. Arise and go look for the donkeys." I don't know about you, but this just doesn't sound real exciting. I mean, there's no giant cursing the armies of God and a little boy with stones. There's no someone cast into a lion's den and God shutting the lion's mouth. It's just Saul out looking for a bunch of lost donkeys. Now, before you say, you know, well, donkeys, what? I mean, this would have been think of if your car was stolen, okay? I mean, this was a donkey was a sizable investment. The fact that there was multiples of them, this was a significant financial thing. So God is using this very, or I mean, how many donkeys got lost in Israel? I mean, this had to be not uncommon. I can see signs put up on trees, lost donkey, answers to the name of Gus or whatever, you know. So it's just stuff. Verse 4, so he passed through the mountains of Ephraim and through the land of Shalisha, but they did not find them. And they passed through the lands of Shalim, and they were not there. Then he passed through the land of the Benjamites, and they did not find them. There's a whole verse of scripture, and we still have lost donkeys, okay? And they came to the land of Zuph, Saul and his servant, who was with him. "Come with us, come let us return, lest my father cease caring about the donkeys and become worried about us." We've hunted for donkeys long enough, and we haven't found them. I would hope Dad's a little worried about me, why I haven't come home yet. But God's up to something using very ordinary means. And he said to him, this is the servant now, "Look now, there is in this city, the city we just happened to have arrived in, oh coincidence that it is not, "Look now, there is in this city a man of God, and he is an honorable man. All that he says surely comes to pass. So let us go there. Perhaps he can show us the way that we should go." And probably the question is, should we go home? Should we look further? Help us find the donkeys. Then Saul said to his servants, "But look, if we go, what should we bring the man? For the bread of our vessels is all gone, and there's no present to bring the man of God. What do we have? So you have two broke guys running around in the wilderness and no donkeys, and Dad's worried about them. Look at the next verse. The servant has a minor solution. And the servant said to Saul again and said, "Look, I have here in my hand 1/4 of a shekel of silver. I will give that to the man of God to tell us our way." In other words, we don't want to show up at the man of God's house and ask for this blessing from God to show us our way without giving a suitable offering. I don't know if the servant had a little, you know, had an emergency coin stashed away in his shoe or whatever, but he says, I'm willing to do that. It says in verse 9, a little explanatory verse, formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he spoke thus, come, let us go to the seer. For he who is now called a prophet was formerly called a seer. And that's just a little explanatory statement for the time of why they use this terminology, which by the time this book is written was no longer in use. And remember, we talked about Samuel being the first prophet. He's the first one that has this sort of lifelong prophetic role in Israel. And others would follow, obviously. A seer is one who can see what others don't see and can see in the realm of beyond that through God's help. Verse 10, and Saul said to his servants, well said, come, let us go. And they went to the city where the man of God was. And they went up the hill to the city and met some young women going out to draw water and said to them, is the seer here? And they answered them and said, yes, there he is, just ahead of you. Hurry now, for today he came to the city because there's a sacrifice of the people today on the high place. And as soon as you come into the city, you will surely find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. For the people will not eat until he comes because he must bless the sacrifice. Afterwards, those who are invited will eat. Now, therefore, go up, for about this time you will find him. Have you noticed we've now gone through 10 verses of Scripture, and we've got lost donkeys, one coin, and finally they're ready to catch up with Samuel. That is so just ordinary, because I think God is setting up something in for us here. And that is simply this. We need to accept the role that God gives us in the ordinary moments of life. The days when your donkeys are lost and you only have one coin. The days when you just do whatever it is that's normal that you do. Don't underestimate those things that are just ordinary. They're very, very important. When our kids were coming up and getting close to leaving the house, part of the advice I tried to give them, a couple things, it was about their work life. One was, an education is important, particularly if you're going into a field that needs particular technical or academic, backing to do that. Education is important. Number two, I gave them this advice. When you get a job, show up on time with a good attitude. You'll be better than about 90% of the people you're competing against in the job market. Just show up on time with a good attitude. You're going to stand. You don't have to do much to stand out in the workforce. Isn't that true? Also, I told them this, and I remember, I don't know who I'm actually quoting, but there's an old saying about if you can find a job you love, you'll never work a day in your life. And then I'd always say, now that's not completely true. Even if you have a job that you love, there's going to be a few days they're going to have to pay you to show up. There's going to be days that it just is tough and difficult. Or the opposite, the additional would be, there's a reason they pay you to do this job. Okay, if it were just all fun, people would do it for free. So just those sorts of advice. But the vast majority of what we do that's just ordinary is whatever we do to provide a living for us and our families. Some of you have worked long enough that you've achieved a retirement. Thank you for your years of doing that. But you did not have that handed to you. You worked for years to get to that point. What is the next bill you have to pay? I can probably figure out who the bill payers among the families are by how much. I mean, is it your electric bill, your water bill? Is it your house payment, your rent? Pay off the credit cards from all the Christmas gifts you bought? What's the next bill you have to pay? I want to encourage you to do something. As you write that, as much as we maybe aren't excited about paying bills, stop and give thanks that he allowed you just through the ordinary workaday life that God has given you, he's providing for you to be able to pay what you owe for whatever it is you receive from that bill. Oftentimes I'm called to do funerals of people, and oftentimes the people that I am having a funeral for have reached an elderly status in life, and they've lived their lifetime. And one of the things that I try to do to honor them, and yeah, we want to preach the gospel and all that, but you want to say something that's honoring to the person, because a life is worth honoring. And I usually try to find out, if I don't know it previously, something about their what they've done in life. And most people, it's just, you know, this guy was a plumber. This man worked in a factory. This man had a small business. This woman was a teacher. This lady was a homemaker. This lady worked in the medical field, whatever. You know, whatever it is. And I usually will try to say something along this effect. You know, that particular job, I doubt that this person really realized how significant it was, because it just seems so ordinary. It seems so small in comparison to many other things. But you know what? That person in that role at that time was necessary to complete the scheme of the fabric, if you will, the tapestry, if you will, of society. I mean, what if all the nurses suddenly went on strike tomorrow? We'd have chaos, right? What if all the plumbers stopped plumbing? It wouldn't be long that we'd have problems. You know what I'm saying? So whatever our role, we are part of God's gift into this world to do what we do. And part of it is just the ordinary stuff. Whether you're a business person, or you're a worker in a business, or you work keeping the books of the office, or you work with your hands, or you're a donkey chaser, or you're a prophet that people come to you when they have lost donkeys, just see that that's your role in the ordinary stuff of life. And somehow that touches into the divine appointment of God. So for those of you that are getting up going to work tomorrow, I'm getting up going to work tomorrow, and when you get up and go to work tomorrow, connect that back to this is a gift. If you got a job, it's a gift of God. And he's given you skills and ability, and this is part of the ordinary that God lets you use in it. Now, we're ready to introduce Saul to Samuel. Verse 14, and they went up to the city, and as they were coming into the city, there was Samuel coming out toward them on his way up to the high place. And so he was going to offer a sacrifice for these people, lead them in worship in a proper way. Verse 15, now the Lord had told Samuel in his ear the day before Saul came, saying, tomorrow about this time I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him commander over my people Israel, that he may save my people from the hand of the Philistines. For I have looked upon my people because of their cry has come to me. And Samuel saw Saul, and the Lord said to him, there he is, the man whom I spoke to you, the one who shall reign over my people. Then Saul drew near to Samuel at the gate and said, please tell me, where is the seer's house? And Samuel answered Saul and said, I am the seer. Go up before me to the high place, and you shall eat with me today, and tomorrow I will let you go and tell you all that is in your heart. But as for your donkeys that were lost 3 days ago, do not be anxious about them, for they have been found. And on whom is all the desire of Israel? Is it not on you and on all your father's house? In other words, God had pre-warned him, pre-informed him that this is the guy. He informs him at the spot. And basically, if I could condense his statement, Samuel says, don't worry about the donkeys, they've been found, but the people that everybody in Israel is looking for, you've been looking for donkeys, but the person that everybody in Israel is looking for is you. I want you to look at Saul's response. 21. And Saul answered and said, am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then do you speak like this to me? He starts out very well. That is a great statement. We want to give some credit to Saul. He starts out, I don't deserve this. My family, my background, and so forth. If only Saul would have ended where he started. I'm going to assume that you know, and we will track this as it intersects with Samuel's life as we go forward, but I think you know some of Saul's life. Rather than passing on the kingdom to his son, he was one and done, okay? He was a one-hit wonder as far as kings go. And God was grieved by Saul and what all he did. And this is number four. Accept that some only start well. And this is difficult. It's difficult. I talk about things you don't really want to do. This is something I really don't want to tell you. But it's the truth, so let me tell you. as you serve God, as we serve God, there's going to be some people that we encounter that start really well, and then they drift away. They flounder, they turn away, they get enticed. It happened to Saul, this one that God had pointed out. This is the one that all Israel's looking for. It happened in Jesus' life. There's a fascinating little encounter or series of encounters that's found in John chapter 6. In John chapter 6, Jesus has just fed the 5,000 with the one little boy's lunch, you know, the five loaves, two fish. Remember that? And it says that he sensed that the people were going to come and by force make him to be king. You talk about riding a wave of popularity. They didn't do approval polling back in that days, but if they did, Jesus would have been off the charts. Okay? Before the chapter is out, as they come to him, and Jesus keeps putting the focus back on the spiritual and away from the physical. I mean, after all, who wouldn't want a king that could feed us every day of our lives, right? Just come to the banquet. Just come. You don't have to work. You don't have to plant. You don't have to plow. You don't have to chase donkeys. Just come and eat. And Jesus keeps putting the spotlight back on the spiritual and the eternal. And before chapter 6 is out, down about verses 60 through 66, it says, many left him and no longer followed him from that point on. Basically, all these people that says, you're going to be king, can't find him. And then Jesus, in some eternal words, looks at the disciples and says, in essence, are you going to go too? And Peter, this is a high point for Peter. We pick on Peter a lot. But Peter says, to whom shall we go? For you have the words of life. The fact that Jesus had many people flocking to him and then many people who fled from him, it's sometimes heartbreaking, but don't let it stop us in our work when there are some who start well. It's sort of like the seed that falls on the stony ground. It'll spring up really well for a while. But then when the sun beats down on it and things get tough, it wanes. I say that to say this, you and I, let's don't lose our resolve because there are some who lose theirs. Just accept, Samuel just keeps going. I don't think he was all excited about what he was called to do, but he did it, and he just kept going. So let's just keep going in spite of what others do. Number five, accept your role. Not only, we talked a little bit ago about the ordinary moments, let's talk about the extraordinary moments. And that's what he's about to do as he is going to anoint Saul, king of Israel. Now, in verse 21, he talks about his family. He talks about his humility and so forth. Verse 22. Then Samuel took Saul and his servant and brought them into the hall and had them sit in the place of honor among those who were invited. There were about 30 persons. And Samuel said to the cook, bring the portion which I give you, of which I said to you, set it apart. And the cook took up the thigh with its upper part and set it before Saul. And Samuel said, here it is, what was kept back. It was set apart for you. Eat, for until the time it has been kept for you, since I have invited the people. So Saul ate with Samuel that day. That's a lot of language that says he gets the place of honor at the meal. Samuel's doing everything he did in this extraordinary moment he did for the Lord. Verse 25, when they had come down from the high place into the city, Samuel spoke with Saul on the top of the house. They arose early, and it was about the dawning of the day, and Samuel called to Saul on the top of the house, saying, get up, that I may send you on your way. And Saul rose, and both of them went outside, he and Samuel. Now, as they were going down to the outskirts of the city, Samuel said to Saul, tell the servant to go on ahead of us. Let him go on. We got to talk here a little by ourselves. But you stand here a while that I may announce to you the word of God. We oftentimes don't think of what's about to occur as a pivotal moment, but it is an extremely pivotal moment in Israel's history where they want to be like everybody else, and God allows, and the course of all future history, in essence, is changed by this change of status. 10:1. Then Samuel took a flask of oil and poured it on his head and kissed him and said, is it not because the Lord has anointed you commander over his inheritance? of all the things that Samuel did in his life, two stand out. This is number one. The second is when he pours a flask of oil over a young man by the name of David's head. And you know some of that story. In essence, if you want to say it this way, Samuel did so much good and did so many things, but ultimately, he was appointed for two moments of oil pouring because he was God's man to direct and to point out the course of how Israel's history is going yet future. You know, there may be some moments in our lives, there may be some moments yet in our church life, if God would will, where we face some extraordinary moments. When they come, go forward with the same enthusiasm, the same leaning forward, the same joy in serving the Lord as all the other moments in life. Five lessons. Be at peace with all that God does. Accept what God allows. Accept that people that we deal with are more externally focused than otherwise. Accept your role in the ordinary moments. Accept that some only start well. And accept your role even in the extraordinary moments. But what's the rest of this day hold? What does tomorrow hold? What does this week hold? What does this year hold? Well, probably most of us say a lot of ordinary moments. Maybe a few extraordinary moments. But whatever the future holds, we just need to be at peace that God is in charge. And we just need to be at peace with whatever He does. And leave it in the Lord's hands.